You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator, and it's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. There are many ways of contributing to society and creating social good. On the podcast, in previous episodes, we've discussed a number of those ways. Everything from donating time and money to making certain types of investments in organizations that could lead to the creation of change and social good. There are also apps and other ways that people are connected, and there are activists who go out and do things that bring attention to problems. Well, we're also hearing that there's a giving pledge where billionaires have pledged to give, as you know, significant chunks of their wealth away, in some cases, all of their wealth in their lifetime. But we've seen that there are bottlenecks in getting that money deployed to charitable organizations and to philanthropic institutions for that matter. And so my guest today is going to talk with us about how we can eliminate some of those bottlenecks. Sean Davis is the founder and CEO of Merton Capital Partners. And his firm is set up to help billionaires think about deploying some of those resources with actual late-stage for-profit organizations, for-profit companies, because those institutions in Sean's purview have the scale to actually achieve social good. So we're going to talk with Sean. Sean, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Thank you, Art. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Sean, you know I'm going to start off with a quote from Tom Merton that is on your website that I find a fascinating way to break the ice, so to speak, for our discussion today. And the quote is, "If you want to identify me, ask me not where I live or what I like to eat or how I comb my hair, but ask me what I am living for in detail. Ask me what I think is keeping me from living fully for the thing that I want to live for." Tom Merton. So with that, what would you say you're living for? How would you respond to that quote?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think that's definitely how I've arrived to where I am. You know, I used to be in Wall Street. I used to work for private equity firms. And then I had this calling, if you will, to see if my skills could be put to work in another way and helping people more directly. And, you know, Thomas Merton was, of course, a monk, and he lived in Kentucky, but he was very close with Martin Luther King, and he was very close with Thich Nhat Hanh and the anti-war movement. And his whole thing was social justice. And now, these days, that term is now relevant again. And so what I did was I was looking to raise money for the homeless in Florida and was doing nonprofit work. And I found that kind of work very fulfilling because you're seeing people and you're trying to help them every single day. So there's high levels of fulfillment versus what I did before, which was maybe sit on a board or write some checks. It's kind of a different experience.
Well, that's really interesting because a number of people that I've spoken to have sort of transitioned from the world of big corporations and providing services to consumers and other businesses. And they jumped off maybe for a calling or simply because it was time to do something else. And I think of one of the people I interviewed, a gentleman by the name of Andre Hughes, who was one of the founding partners at Accenture Consulting. And Andre talks about almost a road to Damascus experience, if you would, where he was told in his mind by a higher power that he should be using his skills for social good. And he went out and started a venture to help digitize charity information so that it could achieve greater scale. And the two of you seem somewhat aligned in this desire to take charity work to scale. Your approach is through better financing of charitable dollars, of making sure that this great wealth that is consolidated in the hands of 3,000 or so billionaires can actually be deployed for social good. And you have an interesting approach in that you believe that some of this money certainly should go to charities, but that charities seem to have some bottlenecks. There's a bottleneck issue that we need to get beyond. How do you see us getting past this bottleneck, and where does this bottleneck come from?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And that's at the heart of kind of where we are. Because I came from the world of later stage private equity, I had this kind of idea of how do we finance affordable housing, for example, for the homeless, not just one building or two buildings, but the whole need for a county or a state or even the country. And what I found was working in nonprofits that because we've starved nonprofits from resources to invest in a lot of key management areas like planning and like systems, nonprofits aren't generally ready to take in $100 million or $200 million and quickly scale. Of course, everybody would like to take that money, but it's very hard. And people who are specializing in giving at that level find that there are very few nonprofits that are really ready to double in size or triple in size. And if you don't have those systems in place and the management teams in place and the planning in place, it's even hard to justify those gifts to begin with. And so that's kind of what I saw, and I called the Giving Pledge bottleneck, was that the original signers of the Giving Pledge and those who have come on board, even a few weeks ago, there were 14 new ones, their wealth continues to accumulate in huge, huge volumes. And the giving rates are very small because nobody's really coming to them every week and saying, here's a $200 million plan to end this problem in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And here's another $500 million plan to do this. And so we really can't expect billionaires to just give up their day jobs and just, you know, build teams to go deploy their capital per se. And so there is definitely a bottleneck that has gotten worse. And there is a solution, but that's kind of what the problem is in short.
So have you seen any willingness on the part of some of these highly financed and highly wealthy individuals to support this type of initiative?
Yeah, definitely. There have been several initiatives. One of the most interesting ones to me is Blue Meridian Partners, that obviously came out of the Edna McConnell Clark Foundation. And they were able to attract a group of 15 or 20 billionaires to basically co-invest in the large grants that they were already giving to a few nonprofits. So the idea was, let's give more money to fewer nonprofits. And they've been working on investing, deploying $200 million per nonprofit, which is a huge amount. Nobody else across the globe is doing things in that way. But it's not just a grant. It's really working with them to develop a 5 or a 10 year detailed plan to see how that would work. And then as you're able to do that with more and more nonprofits, you can take in more capital. But at a certain point, you max out at the number of nonprofits that can truly take in 200 or 300 million and really scale, unless you're taking the McKinsey Scott approach, which is a sort of a trust-based philanthropy where you're giving $50 million or so to nonprofits you haven't really met and have no real strings attached. And that's also another beautiful way to scale things, but it's less based on detailed growth plans, if you will.
So now if I were to ask you, as someone who's in the nonprofit sector, where do you believe that these numbers are coming from? For instance, one of the points you make is that there are only a certain number of nonprofits that are able to handle that amount of money. What do you believe that number is currently? Where are we in terms of the numbers of nonprofits that you believe could handle seriously solving those kinds of problems?
Right, right. I think the number is quite small. Like anecdotally, from the people that I've spoken with at these different groups, they're struggling to find a nonprofit that can take in $200 million. Now, it's important to like clarify that when I say take in, I mean to truly scale their operation and kind of build out. It's not necessarily to endow programs or to build a few buildings. And even $200 million locally, it's hard to solve any problem, even say at a county level, with $200 million. Now, when you're talking about national or global, you're talking about much larger amounts. And so the question is, how much can they take in during a 10-year period? But I would say in my book, I talk about even if we found 150 nonprofits that could take in $200 million, that's $30 billion, which is an ocean of money, but it's only 5% of the giving pledge when it was worth maybe 2 years ago. You know, there is a lot of room to scale nonprofits, and we need more people like Blue Meridian to do that on behalf of billionaires. We're basically outsourcing that process. But after a certain amount, if we really want to get the capital out, we have to look at for-profit companies, large private companies that can take in much larger amounts to do things that are uneconomical currently.
So conceptually, what we're basically talking about is let's max out the support to charities that are in a position to go to that scale, to go to scale. Let's max that out. And then, or at the same time, let's also look at for-profit solutions to some of these problems with companies that already have the scale and track record for delivering on some of these promises. Now, you know that critics will say, and I'm going to ask you what some of the critics are that you're getting, but some critics would say that when you mix business and nonprofit services, nonprofits may tend to lose because businesses are going to generally be focused on the marketplace and maximizing profit. How do we control for that, assuming that we want to, for instance, eliminate the debt that a housing developer gets and replace that with philanthropy? How do we assure that the community truly benefits and not simply the owners?
That's a fantastic question. I mentioned to you that I started in later stage private equity, went into the nonprofit world, and then I'm basically back into later stage private equity because that's what we need to do to get the money out. But it also addresses the issue that you're bringing up. If I have commitments from philanthropy and I go to a private water operator, water utilities, or a large clean energy company, or a large developer, I'm bringing with me private equity professionals from those areas who are then making sure that the investments that we're making of philanthropy to help them do a lot more than they can. So for example, in the example of clean energy, there are a lot of clean energy companies that a project might not be profitable enough to be approved by the board. But if we invest a certain amount of philanthropy in that project, it makes it reach that minimum approval and you can roll out a large solar farm, for example. Similar with water utilities, you can buy distressed water utilities with philanthropy that otherwise wouldn't be economical. But today you have 21 million Americans who have polluted water at home. And of course, in some of the areas of the worst social justice, worst equity you can imagine. And so there's a lot of private companies that can do good, but it's not economical. So we're coming in not as philanthropists, but as private equity investors and building into the contracts for either an impact loan or an investment, which requires the impact and requires collaboration at certain levels with nonprofits that can provide something that they just can't provide. And so it's interesting. It's really new ground where I'm sitting with a former private equity pro from one of the top private equity firms in the world who's retired and he's a real estate person, helping me look and talk through a negotiation with a developer to develop an impact loan where covenants will be structured into the impact loan to make sure that if an audit of the impact fails, then there's some serious consequences and we have the ability to protect the philanthropist and really do things that haven't been done before. And so ironically, we're tapping into like the most interesting part of private equity to then make sure that the impact is being done in a way that's solution based and not just incremental impact, like we're checking a box for an SDG, but we're actually driving towards a solution. So this is very, very new art. And I would say it's some of the most fascinating calls that we're having with developers and owners of businesses where you are getting to that point where they do want to do more good, but they can't. But then we want to be careful that the impact is prioritized because we're working for the philanthropist.
So when I think about how companies are structured and some of the legal requirements that they have, do you see companies, for instance, that are in business, which most of them are, to maximize return to shareholders, prioritizing even legally, how do they legally prioritize social good? When an investor, for instance, would say, great to do social good, but I want to make sure you're not wasting any of my investment on social goods ideas. I want you to do what needs to be done to maximize my return. Are we able to, for instance, avoid these kinds of potential shareholder derivative lawsuits and things that may come when an investor simply says, don't spend my money on that, spend my money on maximizing my return. If you can raise the prices of these rents, raise the prices. I don't want you to get into contracts with people who are going to restrict that.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the other side, on the flip side of that, there's a philanthropist who says, and some of these old friends from 20 years ago when I was in private equity, and they're coming along and looking at these deals, they're saying, wait a second, why is this developer having upside from our philanthropy, you know, on the other side of it? And so we found these areas where we're looking at it from the point of view of here are massive business opportunities for the for-profit. So in the example of water infrastructure, there's 5,000 water utilities that can be purchased and upgraded. But today, without the philanthropy, those investors say, we can't do it. So the key is getting them to their minimum investment return so they can go ahead and purchase and upgrade those utilities. And we're making sure we're getting impact, but it's not at the cost of their minimum market return. Now, what we don't want to do is we want to make sure they don't profit like way beyond their minimum return. So what we're creating are situations where they can do more business, have the same amount of profit, and be indifferent whether they're purchasing a utility, which is okay, or one which is truly abandoned and generating polluted water. Now, a lot of that, there's a million things to negotiate to make sure that neither side is getting taken advantage of. But the key point is that we can deploy $1 billion of philanthropy in these water utilities, and then 10 billion, and then 100 billion. And at 100 billion, we get clean water to those 21 million Americans. But in the process, the private partners that are working with us are doing just as profitable deals in their core business. And that's what's so exciting about this. And then there's another part, which of course, government money can also come in into these deals because essentially it's like philanthropy. And so there's a lot of components where you can, we're looking for areas of great win-win, basically.
Well, yeah, I would have assumed in some of these cases, particularly in the case of clean water, you might have government entities stepping in to sort of equalize the investment opportunity. And, you know, maybe through some type of financial vehicle like a bond or simply a philanthropic grant from the government, these kinds of things could happen. But I suspect there's no reason why private individuals couldn't do it as well. And the other question I have is, we could look at this as philanthropy. People can do whatever they want with their money. Why wouldn't we simply ask these investors or these wealthy individuals to take their money and invest in these entities and not complicate it with the philanthropic piece. I know we see that in social impact bonds, right? I mean, social impact bonds kind of do that. They're sort of this hybrid where you can make an investment in something if you're a qualified investor, and maybe you'll make a return if the project succeeds, but if it doesn't, then you don't get a return. It seems like you're talking about something very similar, except that there is no return at all necessarily coming back to the investor. Am I right about that?
You know, sometimes what I've found is that a lot of these aren't or, okay, but they're and. So in the case of a large foundation that they want to put, you know, philanthropy to work from the foundation, those are the types of investments that we're talking about currently. But at the same time, we might be offering the same investment to a private investor, and they might say, you know what, I'll just make a 0% return investment. Maybe I'll get my money back. Maybe I won't. Maybe I'll get 4% if things go well, right? So we're structuring things so even the philanthropy may get their money back and a return because the situations are profitable. And so again, we don't want all the upside to go to the for-profit operators. And groups like the Gates Foundation have been investing money from their foundation as philanthropy into private situations and making money. It just doesn't, it stays within the foundation. I think the exciting thing about this whole thing, Art, though, is when you're coming with larger amounts of money to a for-profit and you're coming with people who are used to investing in a direct investing point of view, all of a sudden there's a shift in mindset and we're saying, wait a second, we can actually use these large for-profits as an instrument of good. And we can direct them and create deals where there's a win-win and they profit by going in the direction that we want them to go. When you're talking about Fortune 500 companies, when you're talking about large private developers, that has never been done. And it's very exciting because they actually want to do good as well, but they're limited by their box. And so if we can expand that box in different ways, and like you said, either bring in for-profit investors that are more impact first, but require less of a return, or straight philanthropy, then we have more levers. But the focus is always, how do we scale this and get more rolled out so that we can provide, say, all the affordable housing that's needed for the homeless or for women who are victims of domestic violence in Texas or in the U.S. or in Tulsa, Oklahoma?
Yeah, this is a fascinating idea. And I know that there are some issues associated with it. And some of the issues would be, you know, if you are a philanthropy, you're a foundation, is it truly philanthropic for you to make money off of the things that you're giving money to? You know, that seems sort of counterintuitive, but.
And even finding the terms, like I call what I'm doing now philanthropic private equity, but whether I call it that or later stage investing, I have to explain it for half an hour, what we're doing. But I think it's exciting. I mean, I think there's what you brought up before is so key because people get excited about buyouts or rolling out 100 units of housing, 100 buildings. It has to be very carefully done. And this is where nonprofits play such a key role in the work that I'm doing. The solutions for ending poverty in a city, all of those are hyper-local. And their needs need to be determined by the local populations, whatever they may be. And so you can't just come in and drop buildings. You can't just come in and roll out schools. And there has to be a very concerted effort. And place-based initiatives have really shown us how that can be done. But their challenge is always, where is the capital to scale? And so we're looking at saying, okay, can we bring the capital and partner up with nonprofit developers at the same time as leveraging for-profit developers to roll out more buildings?
Well, I want to ask you a little bit more about some of the mechanics of how this works. And I know we don't want to get too much into the weeds, but let's say I was fortunate enough to make a ton of money and I'm looking for opportunities now. And I'm seeing that there's an overwhelming amount of potential places for me to donate my money, basically overwhelming. And I really do want to achieve scale. And I've had a number of people talk to me recently about how to deploy some of their wealth in social good. And there is this hesitation initially around, well, what do I do? How do I actually make this work? I don't understand this particular world. My world is one of products and services and making a return on investment. I don't know anything about how to achieve social impact. Who do I talk to? All of that. So are you saying that your firm and firms like yours will be in a position to help people think through those questions and get answers to those questions? And what are some of the qualifications and experiences that people you work along with have to make something like that happen?
Yeah, no. And Art, of course, we spent hours talking just about that great question. I think part of it is like, what is the amount of money that people want to give away, right? And because capital campaigns, I think it's something like 40% or so of nonprofits are in a capital campaign nationally. So there are ample opportunities to do something of impact. The robotics machine for surgery in your local hospital, a new building for whatever nonprofit that we can find, Salvation Army. There's a lot of super important philanthropic gifts that can be made that have a lot of impact locally. I think when you start getting into the world of, all right, I do that or I've done that, but now I want more scale. I want to really move the needle on something larger. I think you start entering the world of venture philanthropy, and groups like New Profit, groups like Red F, for years have been looking at how do you scale over many years and do multi-year grants. And they've been very successful at that level. The trouble is, of course, that the bigger a nonprofit gets, the more capital it needs to continue to grow. And it puts more stress on an already stressed system, especially on the fundraising side. But, you know, it depends where they want to go. And you also need more money. Like if you really want to scale something, obviously you need the capital. So it's almost seeing where is that person in terms of the amount of gifts they want to give and the commitment for the longer term. And there's groups like us that can help with that. You know, having said that, we're focused more on the for-profits and taking philanthropy to the for-profits, but there will always be the Blue Meridians of the world and Co-Impact and Audacious that have Lever for Change, the MacArthur Foundation's scaling organization. They have projects currently that are on their website. Audacious has projects that can be funded today that are more at scale. And then you get into the question of how involved the person wants to be. So it's definitely interesting, but like you said, it's very confusing. It's where do I start? And philanthropy, obviously, the whole goal, going back to the Thomas Merton quote, is fulfillment, right? We want to feel like we're making a difference. And so engaging in whatever work you're doing is very important. And sometimes that's hard. And sometimes it really has to be kind of central to what you're doing. And the last thing I would say around, if you're really looking at large scale, whether it's in for-profits or nonprofits, I was speaking at a conference in Austin a couple of years ago. And I said, look, just look for the local venture capitalist in town. Just get four or five of them together and say, I need a 10-year plan to end this. And we need a company, we need a management team. And who is that management team, be it nonprofit or for-profit? How do we improve that management team that's been starved for resources? And how do we get from A to Z? It's not hard from a planning point of view. It's more that it's not being done so far today.
So here's another question for you relative to how we might benefit from some of the companies, because just like in nonprofits, there are some companies that are good and some companies that are not so good. And we mentioned some of the water projects, for instance. These are distressed institutions that weren't able to make investments. Is that because the management and ownership of these institutions were ineffective in what they're doing? They didn't plan for the upgrade of their facilities and weren't able to attract capital. I mean, what went wrong there? And can we depend on these people now to deliver if, you know, at some point they were not able to keep their own facilities up? I am assuming that you're talking about really going in and vetting the leadership of these organizations and making sure that they can deliver, because we can't simply assume that because they're for profit, that they can actually solve the problem and they can operate effectively. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, 100%. And going back a little bit also to your last question, writing grants, writing checks is one exercise, but then venture philanthropy and scaling nonprofits, it's riskier, you know, because you're dealing with changes to an organization, not just supporting an organization. And then when you're getting into the for-profit space, absolutely, it's private equity, it's venture capital. You have to back the top management teams. And that's what we're looking at. So in the case of water, it's not that we're going to each utility and looking to have them continue to run it. A lot of these are just tiny utilities that ran out of money. They can't access the bond markets. They can't upgrade. The tax base isn't there. So we're actually investing in larger water utilities that they are going to go and purchase and upgrade and run those utilities. So we're looking at that management team to do that. But it's truly fascinating because it's easy to get lost in, okay, there's so much impact, there's so much philanthropy, what do we look at? And really what we're focused on is where can you really deploy $100 billion of philanthropy? Now that's an insane statement, you know, because that has never been done, but the capital is there and it's sitting there. And so we have to work with the nonprofits and with the investment banks and with the private equity firms and see how we can do that. And what we're looking at are these really large vehicles, because just like in water, affordable housing is the same story. The tax credit funds that we have in the US run out at a certain amount, and the affordability of buildings that are being started also run out at a certain amount. And so how do we grow that pool? Well, if we use philanthropy to augment tax credit money, we can roll out 20 buildings in Austin tomorrow. Start the process. And by the way, there are 9% tax credit deals that go unfunded in many, many cities in America, where one developer gets the deal, 20 don't, and they need $10 or $20 million in tax credit to do the building. And philanthropy can just step into all of those. So we're talking about $100 billion of philanthropy deployed into for-profit affordable housing developers, which, as you can imagine, they would be delighted to take the capital, right? Because they make the same profit. They make the same amount of money, maybe even a little bit less because of the way we would structure the deals, but they get to do more business. And it's very frustrating to have land ready, all the permits for a 300-unit building that's going to help a lot of the issues that we have. They can't go forward with that. And the philanthropists don't know that they can step in into that tax credit part of the capital structure.
Well, Sean, we're getting to the end, but I wanted to just put this out there. I believe that there are many charitable organizations out there that can scale if they had the resources. They have the know-how, they have the ability, they have the track record, they have all of what it takes to scale. We might ask whether the service or product that they're trying to scale will ultimately solve the problem. But I think that's going to be true whether it's for-profit or not-for-profit. A lot of these ideas are still going to be tested when you get them to scale, because we don't have them at scale right now. It's still a test as to whether it can happen. So I'm really eager to figure out ways to get more nonprofits to be in a position to receive those large gifts. And one way might be through collaborative efforts of nonprofits themselves. And I've been one to really push for more nonprofit collaboration. And if maybe organizations could work together to solve certain problems along a continuum, let's assume, for instance, that we're talking about homelessness. Well, as you and I know, getting a person off the street might be the easiest part of it. But then it's keeping them off the street, getting them to a place where they have the health care that they need, they have the services that they need, they get the education, they get a job, they get the supports in other ways that will keep them off the street. Youth education, for instance, you know, we know there are lots of failing schools, and getting kids to a new school building is just one part of it. Now we got to make sure that they can eat, that they have the proper attire, that they have good books, that they have support at home, that they have things to do after class that keep them viable as students. You know, there are these wraparound services that young people need. And nonprofits working together could organize along that continuum of services to solve the holistic problem. I can see companies working within that continuum as well. I mean, maybe the company does the development, but then the nonprofits provide those wraparound services for those homeless people. Maybe the for-profit builds the schools and maybe provides some of the other services like food, for instance, that schools need. But the nonprofits then are part of projects that give the wraparound services. And I'm hopeful that as you talk to your investors, that you'll take this holistic approach, Sean, so that what the businesses are best able to do doesn't fail simply because there aren't others who are skilled at doing the other parts of this, are actually able to participate and really serve that need. So I wonder if it's possible for those kinds of conversations to take place so that when you're talking with these investors, you can say, we're also building in funding to really solve the problem. It's not simply the assets that we need to put in place to house them. We're also wanting to make sure that we're funding these other services that these people need in order to stay off the streets once we provide the facilities for them. Just something to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my dream would be at one level for every mid-sized nonprofit in every city to be able to answer the question, how much? And not just answer it verbally, but to have a detailed 10-year plan. And you know, what's interesting is that there are venture capitalists or bankers, but there's also MBAs who would love to do that plan for a summer project or for a class, you know, solving what would it take for each of those problems in that location. And yes, absolutely. The collaboration is so key. And that's exactly what we're working on, is baking into the for-profit deals, the contract money, so to speak, for the nonprofits, but also knowing that we need to help them scale to provide the services at scale in that city, you know, and that's also a challenge. And so absolutely, it goes hand in hand. But I would always say you always need the plan to grow the pie beyond collaboration and have the 10-year details on how you get there. I think that's the next step. And again, it's so many MBAs are there dying to do something with social impact.
Well, Sean, this has been great. Can you tell me about, just plug your book real quick so that people can get it and understand more about what we've been talking about today.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So the book is called Solving the Giving Pledge Bottleneck, and it's on Amazon or Springer, which is the publisher. It's just a step-by-step helping to see, help people understand how you go from the nonprofit you love to scaling, some of the issues of scaling, who's doing scaling, what is venture philanthropy, and this new area of, if you will, philanthropic private equity. And it's always a win-win. There's space for everybody and there needs to be collaboration, but we need to understand what's on the other side of the fence that can be very useful to us, especially as every CEO in America that from a publicly traded company needs to do more impact. And the days of incremental impact are going to be coming to an end. And people are looking for solution-based impact. And that's all very new, but all the pieces are there to make it happen.
Yeah, well, deploying the money is really important. And regardless of how we do it, having it just sit there is not helping anybody. So if we can't get it to nonprofits, or if we can max out what we can give to nonprofits, which is my preferable way of doing it, let's max out what we can get to nonprofits. And there got to be better ways of figuring that out. Then let's not let the money sit in investment accounts somewhere, not being deployed for social good. Let's get it out. And even if we have to use some of these more innovative approaches through companies that are later stage. Well, you've been listening to the Heart of Giving podcast. My guest has been Sean Davis, who is the founder and CEO of Merton Capital. Sean, I want to thank you so much for joining us on this episode.
Thank you, Art.
And for all of our listeners, if you're listening for the first time and you'd like to subscribe, you can do that on all major podcast platforms. And I hope you will not only listen, but subscribe. And if you want to donate to us, you can donate by going to patreon.com or going to give.org and clicking on the donate button. And there you can make a donation to support the work of the Wise Giving Alliance. We would certainly appreciate that. If you would like to also leave a review on Apple Podcasts, that would be great as well, because it also helps us build audience. Thank you for listening.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.